Morning.
Morning.
I'm Laurie Adams, worship team member, and pleased to be with you today. Our service is in celebration of Dharma Day, which is celebrated each July on the full moon, this Friday, July the 27th. Dharma Day honors Buddha's first teaching on the Four Noble Truths after he attained enlightenment. We'll hear about the Four Noble Truths in a little bit. To open this service, I would like to share a Buddhist prayer named the Four Immeasurables. May all beings enjoy happiness and the cause of happiness. May all be free from suffering and the cause of suffering. May none be separated from the great happiness devoid of suffering. May all dwell in great equanimity, free from passion, aggression, and prejudice.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Eric Lane Barnes. I am your interim music director, and I'm also a Buddhist. And I volunteered to take this service today to share a couple of things about Buddhism and my path. Om Mani Padme Hum is the best-known mantra of Tibetan Buddhism. Tracing its origins leads one down dozens of historic, linguistic, and spiritual paths, but most sources agree that the chant outlines the embodiment of compassion. The most common meaning offered for the mantra is something like, "Behold the jewel in the lotus." Although some mantras are more or less translatable, Om Mani Padme Hum is not one of them. The jewel in the lotus image, however, does suggest an interesting way to visualize the mantra. I've heard both. It is said that there are six qualities or virtues that are a natural result of applying Buddhist principles to one's life. These paramitas, a word that means crossing over, are generosity, ethics, patience, joyful enthusiasm, mindful meditation, and wisdom. Some scholars say that these six paramitas of Buddhism are embodied in the six syllables of Om Ma Ni Pad Me Hum. Om being generosity, Man being ethics, some say discipline, Ni being patience, Pad, joyful enthusiasm, Me, meditation, and Hum, wisdom. I will refrain from commenting on whether or not there's any specific magic in these six syllables or not, but I do believe meditating on qualities one wants to embody is a practical way to use one's powers of focus. So we're going to chant this mantra. And the first thing I want to do is for us to open up and sing a nice syllables of Om, 2, 3, and Om Mani Padme Hum, 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 Om Mani Padme Hum. Go ahead and say the words. You sound like a room of Tibetan monks chanting when you do that. It's great. Thank you. Excellent. How do you feel? There's something about repeating a mantra over and over again that tends to center one, and it resonates, especially the syllable Om. There's a reason why so many different faith traditions use Om as a reverberant syllable. So those six qualities, again, generosity, ethics or discipline, patience, joyful enthusiasm, meditation, and wisdom. I encourage any of you that are interested in investigating more to do some internet research on Om Mani Padme Hum, and like me, you'll probably find yourself going down several different paths of historic designations and meanings of that phrase. One day, toward the end of his life, Buddha became quite ill, and he knew that he would not live much longer. He gathered his students around him and addressed them, "I am now grown old and full of years. Just as a worn-out cart cannot be made to move along without difficulty, so can this old body no longer be persuaded to move along the path." He gave them a final teaching, including these words, "Be ye lamps unto yourselves. Be your own confidence. Hold to the truth within yourselves as to the only lamp." It just so happens we have these words as a hymn in our gray hymn book, "Be ye lamps." So I wanted to give you a little history of my own experience with Buddhism. It really began in 1986, which is long before most of you were born, I know. I was in my mid-20s, and I had just come out of a long period in a fundamentalist Pentecostal Christian church. And as a gay man, I believed that God hated me. And the AIDS virus was beginning to run rampant, and ministers were saying that AIDS was God's punishment for homosexuals. And so I believed that, and I was terrified that I had the AIDS virus just because I was gay and God was going to punish me. We knew so little about it at that point. In a flash of inspiration, I realized I can't change anything that I might have done in the past, but I can change how I think about it. So I went to a bookstore to look for books on how to change my mind, and I found a book called Who Dies? By Stephen Levine. I had no idea what it was, but I opened it, and I read this phrase, "It is because you believe you are born that you fear death. What was your face before you were born? Who you are, in reality, was never born and never dies. Let go of who you think you are, and become who you have always been." That was so powerful to me, and that embodied what I have always wanted to find in my Christian experience in the church. So I bought the book, and I read it, and my life has changed. My mind was blown. The book is called Who Dies? By Stephen Levine, and I think it's in the program. So I read that book, and then I read the next book, which again changed my life, was A Gradual Awakening, also by Stephen Levine, and that was his practical step-by-step instructions for how to meditate. And I didn't really even know that I was learning Buddhism. I was just like, I'm changing my mind and I'm learning to meditate. And at about that time, I discovered the movie Little Buddha. Who here has seen Little Buddha? Okay, it's a fantastic movie. The movie score is fantastic, and it basically tells the story of Buddha. And there's a fictional aspect where they're looking for the next Rinpoche to replace this elevated lama, and it looks like it's one of three people, and so they go on this search. And it's a remarkable movie in that the worst actor in the movie is not Keanu Reeves. The worst actor is Chris Isaac. So if you can ignore Chris Isaac, Keanu Reeves as Siddhartha is actually quite fine. So it's a beautiful movie, and I've watched it probably about five times, so it's really wonderful. So I began Vipassana sitting practice after reading A Gradual Awakening. And the word Vipassana simply means seeing things as they really are. And I then read Thich Nhat Hanh's Living Buddha, Living Christ, because I had a sense that there was a similarity between the compassion that I was trying to learn in the Christian church and what I was reading and learning through Buddhism. And Thich Nhat Hanh, a Vietnamese Buddhist monk and writer and teacher, writes it very gently and very elegantly, that compassion is compassion, love is love, spiritual awakening is spiritual awakening. So I recommend those three books if you're interested in reading about Buddhism. And then I read more, I practiced more. Through a series of rather remarkable events, I discovered Shambhala, which is an organization, international organization, that teaches and practices Tibetan Buddhism. Found out that we were living right across the street from the Chicago Shambhala Center. And so I started going there, and I started sitting and practicing. And I discovered Pema Chodron, who is an American Buddhist nun who lives at an abbey in Nova Scotia. And she has become, in a very real way, my spirit animal. I love what she says, I love what she teaches, and she really walks her talk. I want to mention briefly that when I was putting some of these thoughts out to some of the worship team, somebody pointed out that the Shambhala organization is undergoing its own scandal right now, that the Sakyong Nipam, who is the head of the organization, has been accused of sexual impropriety. He has decided to step down. And it's a really disappointing thing when that happens, but the truth is no human organization is immune from that, and the more elevated somebody can be, the more tempted that person can be to misuse their power. So for me, the fact that this happened in the organization doesn't discredit what the organization teaches. It just shows that it is so easy for anybody to abuse power, and I'm glad that he's decided to step down and the Shambhala organization is taking steps to heal the hurt and to move forward and to figure out how to keep these kinds of things from happening in the future. So I didn't want to think that I was trying to pass something by. I still believe that Shambhala is a very powerful method of learning. So the first thing that I want us to do a little bit of meditating. So I'm going to sit here in my little meditating seat. Good, you're already getting ready. So there are 1,000 different forms of meditation, thousands of forms. No one form of meditation is better or worse than another. This method that I have learned, I find to be simple on one hand, in that all you're doing is breathing and focusing. That's all it is. But the difficult part comes when you notice what your mind is doing. And that is the mind training of Buddhism. So where's my timer? Here it is. So sit comfortably, but sit tall. Try not to lean against the back of your seat. Part of that is to embody your sitting posture, but it's also to keep yourself from falling asleep. It's really easy. One thing about Buddhism, as I've experienced, it embraces boredom. We have so little systems in our culture for being with boredom. We are so easily distracted. And I found that when I get beyond my fear of, oh my God, this is boring, there's almost always something really powerful for me to be in touch with. If nothing else, then this is all there is right now. So put your hands comfortably somewhere on your legs. Keep your eyes open. Let your gaze fall a little bit in front of you. And don't specifically look. Just let it be what they call a soft gaze. And again, your eyes are open to encourage you to not fall asleep. So you're not like gazing at somebody or something. You're just resting your eyes. Now, breathe in and breathe out as you do. This is not a deep breathing exercise. We're not making ourselves breathe. We're just allowing ourselves to breathe. So let's do, for the space of, let's say, 7 breaths, just breathe in and breathe out and just let what happens happen. was about seven breaths. How many felt a sense of silence that was unusual? We so rarely have opportunities to be truly silent. Oftentimes when we find that we're in silence, we have an impulse to fill it with something, turn on the radio, turn on the TV, or start talking. So silence is okay. Silence is perfectly okay. Boredom is okay. Being restless is okay. Now, to focus on the breath, find a place in your body where you notice the breath. I use my diaphragm, the lower part of my stomach, and I notice when I breathe in how it pushes out. That's where I focus. Some people focus on their nose, feeling the breath coming out of the nose. Wherever the breath appears in your body, that's probably a good place for you to focus on it. So let's do another seven breaths and just focus on the breath going in and the breath going out. And just do that. Just breathe and notice your breathing. Let's do seven more breaths. That was about seven breaths by my count. Did anybody notice your mind wandering? Those that didn't notice it because it actually happened. And that's the thing. We cannot keep our minds from wandering. Our minds will wander. That's what minds do. Buddhists refer to that as monkey mind. Given its own devices, our mind is going to go off in a million different directions. So I've heard people say, I can't meditate because I can't stop my mind. Well, nobody can meditate if the idea is to stop your mind. What you do is you notice your mind. And it's subtle, but it's amazing when you're able to notice your thought and go, oh, I was just thinking. So the method, the Shambhala method is focus on your breath. When you notice your mind going off, which it will do like a nanosecond later, just notice and in your mind say, thinking. And just notice that you're thinking and go back to your breath. So breathe, your mind goes somewhere else, and you go, oh, thinking, back to the breath. And that is the totality of mindfulness meditation. You breathe, you notice your mind when it's thinking, and you come back to your breath. Now, be careful, if you're like me, you're going to want to make your thinking like this really scolding kind of thing. No, it's just, we're just thinking. We're just thinking. We are humans. We do that. We do that. So again, now for seven more breaths, breathe in, breathe out, focus on your breath, and when you notice that you're thinking, try to notice it, and then just say to yourself inside, thinking, and come back to your breath. Let's go for seven more breaths. Another thing we notice when we sit in silence is the sounds that naturally come up. I meditate in my living room, and oftentimes there are dogs barking, there are cars going by, people walking by my house saying things, and When I first started meditating, I had this idea that I had to make everything quiet in order for me to really be able to concentrate. But the fact is, we can't change the world. We can only change ourselves. So when we notice sounds, when we notice the wind coming in the window, when we notice somebody knocking on our door, that's all part of the whole thing. And we just notice it. And we notice that our mind responds to that. So again, it's just thinking and then back to the breath. I have found and I have read that meditating can be just small amounts every day. It is more beneficial to do, say, a 10-minute meditation once a day than it is to try to force yourself to do 20 minutes or an hour. There's a place for doing 20 minutes or an hour, but they have studied the benefits of meditating, and they have found that the way that we can train our minds and the way that we can begin to accept more of reality, accept more of ourselves, we get benefit from just 10 minutes of that a day. So see if you can find 10 minutes a day to do this. And there's an old saying that sit for 10 minutes. If you're too busy to sit for 10 minutes, sit for 15. So one final thing I want to leave you with before we go on to the next section is an image that I got from A Gradual Awakening, which is the second book I read by Stephen Levine. And he said, this visualization was, imagine that you're sitting at a crossroads and there's a train track in front of you and there's a train going by, an endless train with just millions and millions of cars. So as we sit at the crossroads, it's really easy for us to follow each of those cars. Oh, look at that freight. Oh, look at that graffiti. Look, that's a really interesting engine. Oh, a caboose. Oh, there's another. And it's so easy to follow every one of these cars. But if you sit and look at the train, you'll notice that behind the train, there's a tree. And we can see the tree in the space between the train cars. And if we can sit and notice the tree, we'll soon be able to realize that the train is much more of the illusion than the tree is. The tree is much more stable. The train is always changing. And so the train is our thoughts, and the tree is our focus. The tree is our I. We often think that we are the train, but in reality, we are the tree. So you are now experts in meditating.
The heart of the Buddhist teaching can be expressed in the Four Noble Truths. Buddha said many times that the whole philosophy and practice of Buddhism springs from them. The Four Noble Truths are: suffering exists. Suffering arises from attachment to desires. Suffering ceases when attachment to desire ceases. Freedom from suffering is possible by practicing the Eightfold Path. And you're wondering, what is the Eightfold Path? That is right understanding, right intent, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. The word right doesn't also imply that there are eight wrongs. There are no thou shalt nots in Buddhism. This is an English translation of a concept that goes beyond right and wrong. Some prefer to think of the Eightfold Paths in terms of good rather than right, good understanding, good intent, good speech, and so forth. Others use the word compassionate, compassionate action, compassionate livelihood, and so forth. This teaching recognizes that action in daily living is fluid. What is right in one circumstance may not be right in another. As with all Buddhist teachings, we are asked to consider, contemplate, and live the teachings. We are not asked to take anything on faith. It's about self-discovery of the truth of Buddhist teachings. One's awakened heart and mind guide one through the Eightfold Path day by day, hour by hour, and minute by minute.
Thank you. Are you ready for the next level?
Ready.
Okay. In reading books by Pema Chodron, I learned Tonglen practice. Has anybody here had any experience with Tonglen? It is one of the most powerful things that I have experienced. And the word Tonglen means taking and sending. And the idea of Tonglen is that we reverse our natural tendency to move toward pleasure and move away from pain. We actually embrace pain and give away pleasure. And we do that by breathing in pain and breathing out relief. Breathing in pain, breathing out relief. So we start that by thinking and imagining what I call pure land. I've heard others call it pure land. So it's simplicity, purity, clarity. So let's just take just a minute and let's embody and imagine pure land. So let's do a few breaths with that in mind. Oh, and here, we do close our eyes because we're using a lot of mental imagery. So don't fall asleep. You can help it. So imagine pure land, clarity, purity, fresh air, clean space. So that is the basis. We are pure land. We are Buddha nature. Our basic self is good and pure. Now let's introduce a little bit of unpleasantness into that. Think of rough texture like burlap. Think of claustrophobia, heat, maybe something burning. So think about that interrupting the pure land and breathe in the discomfort and breathe out relief. Embody the sense of discomfort as you breathe in, and then breathe out pure, clear relief. Let's do a cycle of three breaths with that. So when I did a class in Tonglen at the Shambhala Center last year, and one person raised their hand and said, I'm afraid that if I breathe in pain and discomfort, that I won't be able to let go of it, that it'll stay. And the teacher said, that's just your ego. That's just your ego attaching more to pain than anything else. So it is our natural human tendency to shrink from pain and to not to want to feel discomfort, unpleasantness. So let's take one more level now and think of an experience in your life. It could be this morning, it could be 15 years ago, in which you were in pain. Physical pain, emotional pain, mental pain. Think of that incident and breathe in that pain and then breathe out relief. Is this making sense? Breathe in the discomfort. Maybe somebody said harsh words to you. Breathe out relief. Maybe somebody physically hurt you. Breathe in the pain of that. And then let it go and breathe out relief. Let's do three more breaths of that. So the next step is to take someone that you know, someone that you love, and think of their pain. This can be maybe your mother or maybe a child. I had a very good friend who died of cancer last year, and I frequently think of her when I start with this step. And I think of the pain when she was dying those last few days, and I breathe that in, and I breathe out just relief and release. So think of that person that you love unconditionally. Think of a pain that that person experiences or has experienced. Breathe that in. And breathe out relief. Breathe out the love. So you can probably imagine where this is going. The next circle is to think of someone that you don't really know very well, but someone that you imagine has had pain in their life. And here's a secret. Everybody has had pain in their life. It might not be exactly like yours, but it feels the same as yours. So think of somebody, perhaps a weight person, perhaps it's someone that you drove by, perhaps it's someone that you only know enough to say hi in the north room. Someone that you don't know very well, and embody their pain. Take on their pain just for the space of your in-breath. And then send out relief as you breathe out. Breathe in the pain, the fear. Breathe out relief, pure love. Take in the pain on the in-breath. Breathe out clear, pure relief on the out-breath. Let's do three more of those. Okay, the next circle. This is taking somebody that you do not like, someone that you have a really hard time with. This can be somebody in your life, someone that you work with, that you just want to strangle. It can be a political person. That's my biggest challenge. And the idea here is, know that whoever it is that rubs you so the wrong way also experiences pain. The worst person in the world that you can think of experiences pain. So whatever that pain might be, you can put some of your own pain on that person. You can put anger onto that person, and that person has also experienced anger. And this is challenging. This is challenging. But let's take in the pain of this disliked person. Breathe it in. And breathe out relief. Breathe in that person's anger. And wish that person well as you breathe out. Breathe in and know that this person has been heartbroken at some point. Breathe out compassion. Let's do three more of those. When I do a session of Tonglen, I like to end with the world, because there is a lot of pain in the world, and it's really easy to imagine different points of pain in the world. Children being torn from their parents at the border, people suffering from earthquakes, a number of natural disasters, people who are political prisoners, think of the entire world and hold that and hold the pain of the world in your in-breath, and then breathe out relief as if you're blowing clear, pure relief onto the earth. So breathe in the pain. Breathe out relief. Breathe in the pain, the fear. Breathe out compassion and love. One more time, breathe in. Embody the pain. And breathe out love. When I took this class last year, I thought, this is magical thinking. This is, we are believing that we are healing the world by sending out these thoughts. And I had a hard time with that. But then I realized what this really does practically is it trains us in compassion. If I can hold Donald Trump in my mind, and if I can wish him to feel better, then I am learning compassion. And that does heal the world. If we, one by one, become more actively compassionate, we will heal the world. And Tonglen can also be embodied in the picture of this Tonglen dog, which is breathe it all in and love it all out. So that is Tonglen. You're all so spiritually aware right now.